We're going to start Genesis chapter 38 through 40 today, but as we usually do, we'll take a little review from the last time, which was chapters 36 and 37 of Genesis. Remember that chapter 36 was the genealogy of Esau, the brother of Jacob, the one that had been deceived by Jacob to receive the firstborn promises, the birthright promises, which meant so much in the ancient times, to get a double portion of the inheritance. This was the genealogy of Esau in chapter 36. Esau became the nation of Edom, and Edom was important because the descendants of Esau came into contact with the descendants of Israel more than practically any other nation throughout Israel's history. Even today, the descendants of Esau are in contact with the descendants of Israel. And I'm referring to the Palestinians and the Jews and what's going on over there in the Middle East. Modern times, contact with Israel. Chapter 37, we see that Jacob favored Joseph over his other sons, gave him the coat of many colors, which was significant in that oftentimes in the ancient world, that meant he was going to be the heir, the one to get the best part of the inheritance. And that caused jealousy amongst the other brothers. So much so that later on, Jacob had two dreams from God, which he told his brothers. And he told the meaning of the dream to his brothers, that eventually they are going to bow down to him. They heard those dreams. They thought he was loco and, of course, became jealous and wouldn't accept that at all. So much so that Jacob's brothers plot to kill him. But instead of killing him on Judah's insistence, they actually sold him to Midianite traders who would take him on to Egypt. That's where we left off the last time, Genesis chapter 37, verse 36, where it says, "Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard." So this is where chapter 37 leaves off, with Joseph being sold to Potiphar in Egypt by the Midianites. However, we take a one-chapter break away from the Joseph story, and we focus on Judah in chapter 38. So in chapter 36, we had focused on the descendants of Esau, got into the Joseph story for one chapter. Now we're going to go away and look at Judah. And this is a very important chapter, and there's reasons why the Joseph story gets interrupted. So Genesis chapter 38 now is going to discuss Judah's family. Word commentary points out that the events that take place in chapter 38 span at least 20 years of time, assuming that Judah's sons married in their mid to late teens. So what takes place in chapter 38 spans 20 years of history. Now, as I pointed out, there are reasons why we left off from Joseph and focus on Judah. And verse number 1 explains one of those reasons. It says, verse number 1, "It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira." So what we have going on, this phrase "at that time" means approximately at that time. Approximately at the time of Joseph's captivity, Judah left and went to the city of Adullam, which was northwest of Hebron. So that's one of the reasons that this story interrupts the Joseph story, is because about the time that Joseph is sold into Egypt, this takes place with Judah. And we focus in on it. The story of Judah and Tamar, and we'll talk about Tamar shortly, is placed in the middle of the story about Joseph. Events that took place around the time of Joseph, that he was sold into slavery, and before the sons of Jacob would go to Egypt. So that's, again, part of the reason why this chapter 38 was inserted. There's also another important reason about the Judah story. Although we're going to see in chapter 38 Judah's shortcomings, The purpose of this account is to prove lineage, to prove who are the descendants of Judah. And why is that so important? Because Jesus Christ descended from Judah. And without this particular chapter in the history of the Bible's history, the Jewish heritage of the descendants of Judah and Perez, it might be unknown or disputed. And believe me, Bible critics would have a field day if you couldn't prove where Jesus Christ came from. But we can because of this history of Judah in chapter 38 and where his sons, how this story developed. Here's a companion scripture going to Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 and 3. Matthew chapter 1, verse number 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Verse number 3. Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And we know that by this story here in chapter 38. And again, that's another important reason why it's in the Bible. Going back to verse number 31 to show you the geography, it said that Judah departed from his brothers. Remember, Judah actually saved Joseph. The other brothers wanted to kill him. But Judah says, no, let's not kill him. Let's make some money off of it and sell him to the Midianites. So he's thinking a money deal out of it, but he actually saves Joseph. Of course, God's behind all of this because Joseph and his descendants are going to receive the promises. So Judah departs and goes to the city of Adullam. Adullam is located, here's Jerusalem right here. Down here is Hebron. This is where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived most of the time, on the very southern border of the land of Canaan. So just a few miles to the north of Hebron is where Judah goes to. Then we come to verse number 2. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he married her and went into her. Now remember, we've been talking about this. God warned Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, stay away from the Canaanites. But here, one of Jacob's sons, Judah, marries a Canaanite. Her name isn't even mentioned here. Her father's name is, but her name isn't mentioned. So Judah, of course, makes a mistake. Abraham and Isaac had warned about mixing with the Canaanites. Judah's wife's name is not even mentioned here. The last part of verse number 2 says, he married her and went into her. Now, if you're reading in the Old King James, it says, he took her and went into her. And in Genesis, taking often has the overtones of illicit taking in a lustful kind of way. So, again, Judah's not very clean in his character here, but he's going to wise up by the time the story is all over. Judah's marriage to the Canaanite woman just about ruins Judah's family. And this is so important because, as we know, David and Jesus Christ come from Judah. And his marriage to this Canaanite woman is not a good deal. Verse number 3, we're going to see she conceives three sons. Verse number 3, she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. I've got those in bold letters. I don't know if you can make that out. Verse number 4, she conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Verse 5, she conceived again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chezeb when she bore him. So we've got three sons here, Ur, Onan, and Shelah. These three have the possibility to be the father of, eventually the descendants, David, and eventually Jesus Christ. That's their potential. Three sons are born to Judah and a Canaanite woman in rapid succession. And again, they're possible successors of Judah's line. Chezeb is brought out, or Chezeb, the last part of verse number 5. And Adullam would eventually pertain to the tribe of Judah later on in their history. Okay, verse number 6. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. She's very, very important to this story, Tamar is. So the first son, again, very important, the lineage here. Judah gets a wife for her, for his firstborn son. Her name was Tamar. In the ancient times, parents often arranged the marriages between sons and daughters, etc. In our culture, that's not done today, but it was back in those ancient times. We see in verse number 6, Judah obtained a wife for his son named Tamar. It does not say in the text whether she was a Canaanite. Some commentators say, yes, she was. Some say that she wasn't. It really doesn't, it's not the main part of this story. Either way, God's going to accomplish his purposes through Tamar, descendants through her. Verse number 7. But again, one of these potential fathers, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. Now, it doesn't say how he was wicked, but he was most likely steeped in the Canaanite ways in some way, and whatever it was so bad that God killed him. Candidate number one, dead. First son. And Judah said to Onan, this is the second son now, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. Now, this is something that's not done in our day and time, but back in the ancient times it was. And it was very, very important to have big families, to have families, and it was very important for lineage, successors, etc., back in those times, that you keep the family name going. There was a name for that custom, and I've got a quote here from the Nelson Study Bible. It was called the levirate marriage. The levirate marriage in the ancient Middle East, for a man to die without having a son was regarded as an incalculable loss. In order to maintain the family line and the name of the deceased, a brother or a near relative would marry the man's widow and father a child and carry on the man's family. This was done in many of the ancient nations in those times. But it was also done in Israel as well. I've got a scripture here on the screen, Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 and 6, where Israel was told as well, if a woman dies and she doesn't have any children, a family member, a brother or a close relative, was to go father a child through her to keep the family name going. So it was very important back in those ancient times. Here's a quote from the New Bible Commentary. It says this: in the time of Judah and Tamar, the brother had an absolute duty to marry his sister-in-law, and the father-in-law was expected to see this duty fulfilled. And the problem here is Judah and his sons were reluctant to do their duty. So it was so important in those ancient times for if a woman was childless, that a relative was to go have a child through her. The father, Judah, was expected to see that this was done. But we're going to see that he doesn't do his duty. Verse number 9. Onan, the second son now, knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass, when he went into his brother's wife, that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing that he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Remember, this one has the potential, the descendant, to be David someday in Jesus Christ. This second son knew that the heir would not be his, and so he doesn't care. Again, it's against God's purposes. Nelson Study Bible says, because of his selfishness and wicked attitude toward his deceased brother, Onan would not allow his brother's widow to have a child. And God had repeated the promises that Israel's descendants would be fruitful and multiply, and of course, he's working against God's will and purposes. And I would add, too, most likely he was wicked in some way that's not even described here as well. So, son number 2 is dead. That leaves one more. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So it appears that Judah appears to blame Tamar for the death of his sons. Like he says, lest he die like his brothers, instead of blaming their wickedness. So he promises his youngest son, Shelah, when he's of age. But we're going to see that Judah doesn't even fulfill that. So what happened is this third son, Shelah, is too young. He's too young to marry. So Judah says, hang around a little while, Tamar. Wait, keep your widow's garb on. And when he's old enough, I'll send him to you. But we're going to see Judah won't even do that. The last part of verse number 11, it says, Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. The Zondervan Bible backgrounds commentary adds this. A woman without children was a woman without legal, economic, or social status. A woman without a household. You know, that's very different from today's world, isn't it? I mean, a woman could be a single woman on her own, and she can make it in this world. But back in those days, it was almost impossible to make it, especially if you didn't have children. Judah here relegates Tamar, through his continuing authority over her, to the protection of her father's household. In other words, he's got her off to the side where nothing can happen. Verse number 12. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. So Judah becomes a widow himself. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Now that you can read over that real quick and not really get the significance of it, but Judah's wife has died. There's only one son left, who's the young one. And Judah all of a sudden just drops everything and goes to where this sheep shearing is going on. Now, if you didn't know about what happens sheep shearing, we're going to talk about that. It says the process of time. Perhaps a year had gone by. Remember, the third son is going to be promised to Tamar. Long enough period to show that Judah had no intention of allowing Shelah to marry Tamar. And she was still wearing her widow's garb. That's a quote from Word commentary. So Tamar is getting the picture here that Judah is not going to send the third son to her to have a child. She's already got this figured out. The Nelson Study Bible says this. The death of Judah's wife means that Judah had only one surviving son. Unless Judah remarried, his posterity depended upon Shelah. And again, the history, the whole history of the descendants, you know, David, Jesus Christ, etc., is all depending upon sons coming from Judah. Verse number 13. And Tamar was told, saying, look, your father is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. Now, there's something going on with this sheep shearing. This word look, in the Old King James, it's behold, which draws special attention to what's going on here. And it's part of the story. Okay, Timnah is located to the north of Jerusalem. Down here is Jerusalem, and Timnah is just a little bit to the north. Down here is Adullam, where Judah got married, and the story is taking place. So he goes north of Jerusalem to this town of Timnah, where the sheep shearing is going on. So what is involved with the sheep shearing? Well, the Nelson Study Bible says the time of sheep shearing was not only a time of work, but a time of celebration. Sheep shearing, according to Word, was a lively festival when wine was freely consumed. So these men go up to shear sheep, but they're also going to what we would call in today's vernacular party down. The Zondervan Bible backgrounds commentary says, sheep shearing time was payday, and the income windfall, the celebratory atmosphere, and the isolation of the men from the family were conducive to activity of ladies of the evening. So this is what happens in this festival, the sheep shearing festival. This brings us to verse 14. So she took off her widow's garments, Tamar did, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown and was not given to him as a wife. Remember, Judah had an obligation to have Shelah go in to her to have a child, and he wasn't performing his duty. She figures this out. This isn't going to happen. She takes matters into her own hands. Okay, we see that Judah does not fulfill his promise in verse 14. She was not given to him as a wife. Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this. Thus the family's future was placed in jeopardy. Tamar felt that she would have to take matters in her own hands if she was to be granted the rights of the levirate custom. Word Commentary says, while not actually saying that she dressed as a lady of the evening, the text implies that the dress and the posture she adopted made her easily taken for one. Verse 15. So when Judah saw her, he thought that she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Now, some of the commentaries point out that she had her face covered, but most of the time, those kind of ladies did not have their face covered. But she did to hide her identity. Verse 16. Then he turned to her by the way and said, please let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? Now this, when you read this, it seems like she's really being deceptive and really trying to work things on her end. But this was her, this was due to her to have a child. Again, according to the ancient customs. So she takes it into her own hands. Verse 17. And he said, I will send you a young goat from the flock. So she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? Now, in today's time, days and time, if a young fellow or a young woman asked for something, you know, a gift from a fellow, and you said you were going to give a young goat, I don't think the lady would be too pleased. But in ancient times, it actually was a good thing. A young goat was a roasted kid, which was a delicacy in those times. So it was actually a pretty good present. And she asks for a pledge as well. Then he said, verse 18, what pledge shall I give you? So she said, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand, which in the ancient times, that was very important for especially a man of authority and a rich man, which, again, all the children of Jacob's children were rich men. So these were important signs of his, the signet, the cord, and the staff. Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. The signet or seal was what a rich man would have, a personally engraved seal, and he carried it on a cord. And the staff was a symbol of authority. Verse 19, so she arose and went away, laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. So she goes back to having the garments of the widowhood like she had before. Nelson Study Bible says, Tamar resumed wearing the clothes of a widow, clothing that broadcast Judah's broken promises to the community. You know, like she was still waiting for the child. Verse 20, and Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive its pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her, because she'd went away. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. So Judah sent his friend to receive the pledge back from Tamar, you know, the staff and the signet, etc., but she couldn't be found. And the men of the place said, there wasn't anybody here. Now, this word harlot that they use in verse 21 from the Hebrew refers to a shrine prostitute, the sacred pagan prostitutes attached to the pagan religions. And apparently they were more respectable than the common one. So that's what they're referring to in saying, no, there wasn't any that kind of woman here in this place at all. Verse 23, then Judah said, let her take them for herself, lest we be shamed. So in other words, well, she can keep them because we don't want to be shamed. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her. So So Judah decides to let her keep the pledges to try to hush the matter. You know, let's kind of put this away here. And he says, shamed or joked, which was a contemptible conduct, contempt for someone that was considered lower than yourself. Verse 24. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So some friends said to her, hey, all of a sudden now she's got a child. And Judah realizes, well, I never did send Shelah into her. What's up with this? So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. You know, she must have been fooling around on the side. Let's burn her. Now, Jameson Fawcett and Brown points out that in patriarchal times, fathers seemed to have possess the power of life and death over members of the family. That's why he could do such a terrible thing. The Zondervan Van Bible Backgrounds Commentary says, the punishment of burning is a rare thing and reserved for the most serious of sexual crimes. In the ancient Near East legal texts, it's likewise a rare punishment, but used in similar circumstances. So it was very rare that a family member would be burned for something like this, but Judah says that's what he wanted to do. Verse 25. When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. Please determine who these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. So she sends to Judah his own signet, staff, and cord and says, hey, whose do these belong to? Verse 26. So he acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give Shelah my son, and he never knew her again. So Judah wakes up and he realizes, you know, I had a duty to perform here, and I didn't do it. And she actually took matters in her own hand and did what was necessary. He says, she's more righteous than I. And it was a good thing that she did this, because they would have descendants. The Nussel Study Bible. Judah, one of the heirs of the everlasting covenant with the living God, was put to shame by a Canaanite woman. To his credit, Judah confessed his sins. The New Bible Commentary. Tamar, a widow, had no legal redress against his father-in-law's injustice. So she contrived to trap him. She outwitted him and obtained her rights under the Levirate law and two sons for the household of Jacob. So everything that she did was, in legal terms, done rightly in the ancient world. And two sons were born to Judah of the household of Jacob. Verse 27, now it came to pass, and this is going to be a story that you'll recognize, at the time for giving birth, that behold, twins were in her womb. Now remember, these are important descendants. And so it was, verse 28, when she was giving birth, that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Now, that sounds kind of strange in our day and time, why a midwife would be waiting to put a scarlet thread on one of the children. But remember, the firstborn always got the double portion of the inheritance in ancient times. It meant everything back in those days and time. So to make sure which one came out first, she's ready to put this thread on. And she puts it on the hand of this one that stuck his hand out. Again, twins were known to be a special blessing from God, and this account is parallel to the birth of Jacob and Esau, who were twins also. Both twins in each account compete to be first, and the older one has to take second place. All throughout Genesis, it's always the younger one that comes out ahead. And again, that's according to God's purposes. The Nussel Study Bible. There could be no mistakes in identifying the firstborn. Again, inheritance rights are involved. The midwife used a scarlet thread to make sure everyone knew which baby had been born first. Then it happened, verse 29, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. So the one had stuck his hand up, got the scarlet thread, draws the hand back, and then the other one comes out. And she says, "How did you break through? This breach be upon you." Therefore, his name was called Perez. And Perez means breach or breakthrough. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Zerah means arising of light or shining brightness. And Companion Bible adds this, both Perez and Zerah together are in the genealogy of Christ, Matthew chapter 1, verse 3. We read that earlier. And they're in that genealogy because they're twins. And it's through Perez that eventually David would be born, and again, Jesus Christ later on as well. So that's why this history is important, and it interrupts the Joseph story. Now we go to chapter 39, go back to the story of Joseph. Barnes Notes says, Perez and Judah were born. That's a typo there. Perez and Zerah should be. Were born when Judah was in his 28th year, and therefore Joseph in his 24th. We have to go back 7 years to resume the story of Joseph. So again, that story of Judah spanned 20 years. Now we backtrack 7 years to pick up where we left off with Joseph. The children of Israel who came out of Egypt, upon reading this story when they're going to the promised land, would understand how their descendant or how their family members, their parents, became slaves in Egypt by reading this particular story. Verse number 1, chapter 39. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Remember, he'd been sold by his brothers. And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. This is a familiar section of scripture to all of you, but again, very, very important. Here's an important side note. Instead of being sold to construction crew, slavery crews, remember, in this point of history, Egypt was known for building their pyramids, their sphinxes, and all their grand building projects. Joseph could very well have been sold to one of those construction slavery crews. But God was with him. And he was sold to a high officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. The Lord was with Joseph, we find in verse number 2. And he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. So this theme, the Lord was with Joseph, is the overall theme as we go through this chapter, and it's going to be repeated again in verses 21 and 23. Verse number 3, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. So not only was God with him, but the high Egyptian official, the captain of the guard, Potiphar, realized there's something special about Joseph. Something special. And that the Lord made all that he did prosper in his hand. Now this guy was a pagan, you can believe it. He was a pagan sun worshiper, worshipped all the gods in Egypt, but he knew there's something different about Joseph. And as it's described here, the Lord was with him. Verse 4, so Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. That's amazing right there. This man probably had all kinds of servants and slaves. Joseph comes on the scene, and boom, he's put up as chief overseer of the household. Again, God was with him. Here's a map for you. Potiphar, this is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, means one devoted to the sun, and the local deity of An or Heliopolis. And it fixes the residence in the delta. So Heliopolis, or On, where Potiphar was, is right down here in the delta region of the Nile River. So this is where this is taking place. Potiphar and his state prospered because Joseph, God was with Joseph. Verse number 5. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was all that he was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So this Potiphar's household begins to take off. Things are going well because of Joseph. In this story now, remember Abraham said that you're going to be a blessing to all nations. You will be a blessing. We see how it begins to be fulfilled. God had told Abraham in Genesis 12, verse 2, I will bless you and you shall be a blessing. And Potiphar, this Egyptian, saw that the blessing was from God, even though he worshipped other gods. Verse number 6, thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. So everything was in Joseph's charge except for the food. Everything. Now we have this phrase, the last part of verse number 6. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Word commentary adds this. Joseph's mother, Rachel, is also described as beautiful of form and appearance. Chapter 29, 17. They are the only two people in the Old Testament to be awarded this double accolade. So only Rachel and Joseph are the only ones described in the whole Old Testament as being what we would call today good looking. Verse number 7. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Jameson Fawcett Brown adds, the ancient women of Egypt were very loose in their morals. And I think that's pretty obvious. Verse number 8, but Joseph refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. Verse number 9, there is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me, but because you are his what? Nor has he kept back anything from me, but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So he said, I have control of everything in this house except for you because you're his wife. I can't do this and sin against God. Now some study Bible. Joseph exemplified the highest standard of personal behavior. The empowering presence of God in his life helped Joseph to resist temptation. Verse number 9. He says, how can I sin against God? Here Joseph not only stood up for his ethical beliefs, but he also told a woman, who probably believed in many gods, about the righteousness of the only true God. So he's witnessing to her as well. This is a statement from the Nelson Study Bible. And Joseph calls adultery a sin here, which helps us understand that the Ten Commandments were in force before the time of Moses, that Joseph understood that adultery was a sin. Verse number 11, but it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house were inside that she caught him by the garment saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Now, she grabs his garment. It sounds like he just kind of slipped away, but there's more to it than that. Okay, she waits until there isn't anybody else in the house to serve as a witness of what she's doing. It says that she caught him by his garment, which from the, that's our English word caught, but from the Hebrew that implies violence. She didn't just grab it, she was in a violent way. Word commentary says, the main items of attire in patriarchal times were the mid-calf shorts and a tunic, a long shirt. To pull either of these garments off against the wearer's will must have involved surprise and violence. In other words, the type of clothing that he had, in order to pull it off, she had to really be wrenching on it really, really hard in a violent way. Verse number 16. So she kept his garment with her until her master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you bought to us came into me to mock me. So she puts Joseph down with her words. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside. Of course, he's telling a lie in all of this. The Nelson Study Bible says this. The Hebrew term is used only four times in the book of Genesis. This word Hebrew is only used four times in the book of Genesis. Here, it's a racial slur. So she's really putting Joseph down. And to mock, the verb suggests racial hatred. The Hamitic Egyptians scorned the Semitic people of Canaan. So she's not only saying that, accusing him, but she's putting him down with racial tones as well. Verse 19. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did this after this manner," that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. According to Egyptian customs and law of that day, Joseph could have been killed for adultery. But again, God is with him. He's only put in prison. Even though Potiphar's wife's story aroused Potiphar's anger, he did not have Joseph killed, but rather put into prison, which he was able to do because he was the captain of the guard. Again, he could have had Joseph killed for this. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, to account for the lightness of the punishment, considering the severity of the Egyptian law as to adultery, it is possible that Potiphar was not fully convinced of his wife's chastity and therefore did not place unlimited credence in what she said. Now, that's kind of a long statement, but what it's saying is that Potiphar really didn't believe his wife anyways that of what had taken place. That's why he didn't have Joseph killed and only had him put into prison. All of this, though, is God's design. It's going to work to God's purposes. The New Bible Commentary. To be incarcerated in a royal prison on a false charge was a tragic fate for such a loyal servant as Joseph, though he was not the last to suffer for righteousness' sake. 1 Peter 2, verses 21 through 25. Joseph is often regarded as a type of Christ, the perfect servant who was unfairly condemned. And I mentioned this to you in the last Bible study when he was sold to the Midianites, probably chained on the way as he was drug off to Egypt. He'd been first put into a pit by his brothers. Joseph suffers this whole story in many, many ways. And yet, he keeps the forward vision. There's no woe is me. Why am I going through all of this? God's design and purposes are in Joseph's mind. And that's why he's regarded as a type of Christ. He's unfairly treated, but he took it and suffered. It's a lesson for all of us. Verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph, showed him mercy, gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. It shouldn't be amazing to us. He's there put in charge of Potiphar's house. Now he's plunked into prison. Now he's put in charge of the prison. God's with him. Verse 23. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority. In other words, Joseph had full authority there because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. God continued to be with Joseph, prospered in prison. This word mercy means from the Hebrew loyal love, which God showed to Joseph. It says in verse 22 that God gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown adds this. The keeper might have been previously associated with Joseph and had access to know his innocence of the crime laid to his charge and will all the high integrity of his character. So what this is saying is that most likely the keeper of the prison realized that Joseph was put in there under false charges anyways and goes and has mercy on him as well. And he's in charge of the prison under the keeper of the prison. That brings us to chapter 40, which is a short chapter, and we'll breeze through this. We're going to run across two men in the prison. the chief butler and the chief baker, Pharaoh's chief butler and chief baker. These two men were responsible for serving meals to the king. Very, very important position. And why is this so important? Because assassination attempts were made through the meals. If you've ever watched the movie of Cleopatra or some of those movies depicting ancient times, they had their food testers and their wine testers. Somebody had to eat or drink before the king did, because that was a way that assassination attempts were made. So the chief butler and the chief baker were responsible for what Pharaoh ate and drank. Very, very important positions. That brings us to verse number 1. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Now, how did they offend Pharaoh? Most likely, Pharaoh got sick. I've got it in a question mark here. We don't know. Most likely, he got sick and said, off to the dungeon with them two. Verse number 2. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in the custody of the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. I don't think that was any coincidence. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. Verse number 5. Then the butler and the baker, again, these were high positions in Egypt, serving Pharaoh. The king were confined in the prison. They had a dream, both of them. Each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. Back in those days, dreams meant a lot more to those people in the ancient times. We'll talk about that in a moment. The Nelson Study Bible says, these were not ordinary dreams. They contained symbols that demanded interpretation. Verse number 6. And Joseph came into them in the morning and looked at them, and they were very sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, why do you look so sad today? So they'd had these dreams, and they're moaning about it, that they couldn't be interpreted. Verse number 8. And they said to him, we each have had a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. So Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. Now here's an important side note about those ancient times. This is from the Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary. Dreams were considered important vehicles of divine communication in the ancient world. Notice this. Trained specialists interpreted the dreams of important people and paying customers using dream books. These books were consulted for the meaning of symbols and dreams. So in those ancient times, and especially Egypt, there were these men that went around that were special interpreters of dreams. And they had these books where somebody would pay them and say, all right, I had this dream. I had a dream about a cat last night. And the guy would look in the book. And then he'd say, here's the meaning of that dream. That's what these guys are looking for, to have this interpreted by these dream interpreters with their books. And Joseph says, wait a minute. Interpretations of dreams belong to God. Joseph realized that their dreams were from God, and he was working his will out through more dreams like the ones that he had had previously. Verse number 9. Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, behold, in my dream, a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. And though it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Verse 11, then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. So now imagine this. Most likely, the chief butler had told this to one of these dream interpreters. He looked in his book and says, oh, I can't find anything about vines and cups. I don't understand. Joseph's going to interpret it. In verse number 11, he says that he pressed them into Pharaoh's cup. The Companion Bible adds this. This was a religious ceremony connected with the worship of Horus. So this was also very important with Pharaoh because he's doing a religious ceremony when this pressing of these grapes go into the cup. The chief butler, the cupbearer, had a dream that's going to have a favorable interpretation by Joseph and by God. And Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it." Joseph didn't need to look at a book. God was with him. Three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head, take him out of prison, in other words, and restore you to your place. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand, according to the former manner, when you were his butler. So you're going to go back, you're going to participate in this religious ceremony, and you're going to give him the cup like you always did before. You're going to be out of prison. So he receives a good interpretation. His life is going to be spared, the chief butler. But Joseph adds this, "But remember me when it's well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house." So he asks a favor of the chief butler. "Remember me now when you're spared by Pharaoh. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews. And also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon. I'm really innocent," Joseph is saying. He mentions the land of the Hebrews is where he was taken from. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, "The neighborhood of Hebron might so be called from the long residence, the immense substance, and the powerful influence of the patriarchs among the Canaanite tribes." In other words, there really wasn't known a land of the Hebrews back in that time in Egypt. But he was just talking about the place where he had grown up with his family. Verse number 16. "Now when the chief butler," chief baker, this is the second individual, "saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, 'I also was in my dream, and there were 3 white baskets in my hand. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head.'" Remember, with the chief baker, he's responsible to give food to Pharaoh. "And the birds are eating out of this basket in his dream." So Joseph answered and said, "The interpretation of it is this. 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you." So in other words, you're not going to get taken out of prison. Your head's going to get lifted off. "Hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." So the chief baker does not receive a good interpretation. His life will not be spared. Verse number 20. And we're coming down to the end here now. "Now it came to pass on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that they made a feast for all of his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker among his servants." Jameson, Fawcett, Brown adds this. "This was a holiday season, celebrated at court with great magnificence and honored by a free pardon for prisoners." So it's Pharaoh's birthday, but it's a very festive season. And when they had this festival, Pharaoh's birthday, it was a time to release political prisoners. Verse 21. "Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." So the chief butler forgets Joseph, but God would not forget him. We're going to see this as we go through the story in the next time. The Bible Knowledge Commentary adds this. "In this hope, Joseph has persistent faith. His faith was not destroyed by circumstances." You know, Joseph, he just continually has all these strikes against him. Here's another one. The chief butler gets saved, forgets him. But there's no "woe is me" out of Joseph. He keeps going forward. Verse 22, we see that Joseph had interpreted the dreams. Expositor's commentary adds this. "The picture of Joseph that emerges from this narrative is precisely that which Pharaoh himself later expresses. Joseph is one in whom is the Spirit of God. So Pharaoh, probably the most powerful man on the face of the earth, expresses this. We'll see this the next time. There's something different about Joseph. And he even says the Spirit of God is in him. Joseph then represents the kind of leadership that the readers of the Pentateuch would be called on to follow. Joseph, like Solomon, is a picture of a truly wise leader who understands and sees the will of God in the affairs of those around him. That's the end of the chapter, but I'll leave you with some lessons from the study today. First of all, going back to chapter 38, this is from Word Bible Commentary, it says this: the story of Judah and Tamar, which seems to be at first sight so marginal in biblical history, records a vital link in saving history. Tamar, through her determination to have children, secured for Judah the honor of fathering both David and the Savior of the world. So again, this story is very important because it links their children to David and eventually to Christ. Chapter 39. Joseph is untreated fairly by Potiphar's wife. He's imprisoned. It's a type of sufferings that the righteous often must endure. He suffers time and time again, just like the righteous must endure. Here's a companion scripture, 1 Peter 2, verse 19 through 21, as this is a lesson for all of us. For this is commendable, because of conscience towards God, that one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, like Joseph did, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. Verse 21, for to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. So again, this Joseph story, even though it's very simple, is a good lesson for each and every one of us. You suffer wrongfully, but you do it for righteousness' sake. And finally, the last lesson from chapter 40, Joseph's faith did not waver despite his circumstances in prison. And because of that, God would not forget him. And that brings us to the end of the Bible study today. Any questions or comments?